Hi, everybody, and welcome to The Stone Chapel, a podcast of the staff and friends of the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, Texas. My name is David Capes. I'm the Senior Research Fellow at the Library and your host for this series of podcasts. Our purpose is fairly simple. We want to bring to you great conversations with leading experts from around the world on biblical, theological, historical, and archaeological themes. Well, the list goes on. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Joining me today on the Stone Chapel is Dr. Nijay Gupta, Professor of New Testament at Northern Seminary up in suburban Chicago, Illinois. He's the author of a number of books and just a well-known young scholar who's doing some terrific things, both in scholarship but also for the church. And so it's a pleasure to welcome Nijay to the Stone Chapel.
Thanks, David, and thanks for calling me young. My kids don't think I'm young, but I appreciate it.
Hey, well, I'm 64, so, you know, everybody looks young to me these days. Hey, we're going to be talking about your book, and it's a terrific book. It's called Paul in the Language of Faith. It's published by Erdmann's Publishing, which is a great publisher, and you've done a great deal with this book, and I want to chat with you a little bit about what's going on in the book and some of the conclusions that you reach, because that language of faith in Paul is just so crucial. And it can be so misunderstood as well. And so I want to see how you're trying to correct us at that point. But one of the things that I want to mention, and I would be amiss if I didn't, that the foreword in the book is written by Jimmy Dunn, or James D.G. Dunn, who passed away recently in the summer of 2020. And I know you knew him, but I just thought we'd take a moment and give homage to our friend.
Yeah, you know, Jimmy is such a towering figure. I remember very, very distinctly in seminary, spending time in his many books, some of his works on Christ and the Spirit, his theology of Paul. And I was just so struck by his ability to look at the big picture of the New Testament, of really Christianity, of Paul. And his work was rigorously academic, but he was also really faith-friendly in his literature. He's very interested in the church. And so actually one of the reasons I wanted to study at the University of Durham was so I could spend some time with him. He was retired, but I got a chance to have coffee with him every couple of months when I was in Durham in his retirement. And such a delightful man, gentleman, very good-natured, you know, loved to laugh. And just very, very warm as a person. But I really feel like one of my goals in my career is to carry on his legacy of that rigorous scholarship, thinking big picture about the New Testament, about New Testament theology, about Pauline theology, following the evidence where it goes, you know, being able to say you don't know if you don't know. But, you know, he was also such a great mentor, and he's mentored some of the best scholars of our generation, Bruce Longenecker, Simon Gather Cole. So I just have benefited so much from him. I reached out to him, asked him to do the forward. He was so kind about it and offered just really nice forward. So I, you know, I'll miss him, but I really appreciate the mark he left on scholarship and the church.
Some scholars can be a bit cold and prickly, you know, but Jimmy was warm and inviting.
Yeah,
both to his students, but also to me. I was never a student or a student at University of Durham, but we often sort of squared off on papers and agreed and disagreed. But he was always a great gentleman to me. So
yeah, absolutely.
We give thanks to God for the life and legacy of Jimmy Dunn. And might it be that you would carry that on in your own way?
He was also a family man, and you know he spent a lot of time with his wife, Mita, and he actually moved down to southern England after his retirement to be with his children and grandchildren. And so just always thinking about family. We get these newsletters, I don't know if you ever got them, but they were always about family. And it was just so rich to see that, and such a great testimony to how you can live a balanced life.
Exactly. Well, let's talk about your book, Paul in the Language of Faith, published by Erdmann's. 2019, I think, was the date, wasn't it? Was it 2019?
So
or 2018.
It's a little bit confusing.
I'm trying to remember.
It's a little confusing because it technically came out in 2020, but they released it.
Oh, did it?
They released it at SBL in 2019, the Society of Biblical Literature Conference, because I said, can we get it to the conference? And they were really, really gracious about getting the book to the conference so that scholars could pick it up and look at it. There was a review session at SBL as well. So it actually came out
for that. It was great.
4 or 5 months before the actual, you know, date. It's kind of like with cars, like the 2020 model will come out.
Started to say, it's like the new Ford Ranger. It's already come out, right, for 2021. So what's the big idea behind your book? I tell my students that every good book has a big idea.
Right.
And the first thing you want to do is you want to try to understand what that big idea is. What's the big idea behind your
book? Right. Let's start a little bit before that with the big questions behind the book, because research is all about big questions. So, a long time ago, maybe 7, 8 years ago, I was asked to write a dictionary article on faith in the Bible. And, you know, I kind of had my, you know, bearings right with faith in the New Testament, but then I had to think through what's faith mean in the Old Testament. And I expected to find that the Old Testament doesn't talk about faith. But as I investigated it, and as I investigated texts from what we call early Judaism, the time around Jesus and Paul, I came to realize there are actually all sorts of conversations about what we call faith language in Jewish texts, in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And that really got the wheels turning about thinking more carefully about that language. That was one conversation in my head as I approached this book. A second conversation involves what scholars call divine and human agency. So scholars are really interested in the last 20, 30 years about this conversation about in this, let's imagine salvation as a formula, which is terrible to think through, but let's imagine it's a formula. What role do humans play, or what do they contribute? What does God contribute? So there's all these different views and discussions, and scholars have talked about righteousness, law, grace, salvation, but the language of faith really hasn't played much of a role in that conversation. I wanted to bring that. A third piece of the puzzle was the popular use of faith language in the church. So sometimes faith language can come across as doctrines, like things that you write down on a piece of paper. And I don't think that's what Paul meant. Sometimes people have used faith language as if it means opinion. Like, I can't prove the resurrection, I believe it by faith, which means there's no proof. And I don't think Paul meant that either, but I hear people use faith language in that way. And then some people use faith language as if it's the opposite of works. I remember one scholar talking about faith as recumbency on Christ, the soul's recumbency on Christ. And there's that language of not doing, and there's some scholars today that kind of double down on that and say faith is the essence of not working for your salvation. And as I've studied Paul over the years, I felt that's not right either. So what I sought in this book is to just really take a careful, close look. I remember one of my friends who read the manuscript before it was published said, is this just a really big word study? And in some ways, it is a big word study, because this is the way I approached it. I really wanted to look at all the keywords and figure out, what does Paul mean when he says this? So if you want to know what the big idea is, I'll tell you about one of the big discoveries I made and how everything revolves around that. So as I was investigating what faith language might mean in a Jewish context, I came to discover that Jews around the time of Jesus and Paul started to use pistis, which is the Greek word that we translate as faith, as a way of talking about a covenant relationship. We find that in the Septuagint, which is, as I mentioned, is the Old Testament. We find that in Josephus. We find that in some ways in Ben Sira, which is in the Old Testament Apocrypha. And what I came to realize is we think of faith as primarily something that happens in your head. But if you take into account how everyday Greek-speaking people in that time used faith language, if we talk about how Jews used faith language, it was at its core, a relational term. Now, having said that, you think of it like this, like a planet, right? There are all these things that kind of orbit around it. And so I came to think of Paul's faith language really not just as one thing, but really an elastic term that covers a spectrum. So if you think about that relationship with God, but then faith can be a variety of things along a spectrum. One end might be faith as belief, which leans more in the cognitive realm, the way we see reality. And then on the opposite end, you might have faith as what I call obeying faith, which is kind of that thing that pushes us to do and to act. But then sometimes faith language can be either in between or kind of comprehensive, which I call trusting faith, which is really just what we might call trust. And that's something we do with our will. So the two big ideas I would say of the book are faith as covenant language, and then faith as this way of using language that can, in a given instance, move across the spectrum of uses.
Well, one of the big challenges in translations, you know, and this is a translational question, right?
Yes.
Because every time, and there are translations that want to be very specific, every time the word pistis occurs, they want to translate the word faith. Or I remember looking at the word logos a few years ago in the New American Standard Version, right? Most people translate that word, but within the Gospel of John, the word logos is translated 22 different ways in the New American Standard, right? It's such a difficult word to translate to begin with. And what I appreciate so much about what you've done is to show us that you can't just always plug in faith when you see the word pistis from the dictionary.
Right. Well, you know, and I knew that that was going to be an obstacle for some readers. So I wanted to give examples where we see this naturally happen in the New Testament. For example, there's a Greek verb sozo, which means in its sort of basic meaning save. And so we see in the Gospel of Luke, really all the Gospels, but I use examples of Gospel of Luke where it says, your faith has saved you. Now that's you, that same phrase is used twice in Luke, once for forgiveness, and then it's translated, your faith has saved you. And another time it's used for healing, and it's translated, your faith has made you well. Now, the reason that is because it's a healing, and therefore it's made you well, but it's the same word in Greek, and you would connect the two, but you realize based on context, maybe you need to nuance it a bit, and that's what I'm asking for with Paul's faith language.
Yeah. Well, some of the texts that you've looked at are just really incredible. I wanted to ask you about one or two of those, and then I got some other questions too in the time that remains. One of the passages that you deal with, I think, it's toward the end of the book, is Romans 1:16-17.
Right.
That a lot of people have heard. A lot of people describe it as kind of the central idea of the book of Romans,
right,
or kind of a
thesis,
a thesis statement, for the book of Romans. And I'm gonna, let me just read it briefly here, and you'll hear my dogs in the background, by the way. So my wife must be home. We're working remotely in these times of COVID. Paul says, "For I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it, that is in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed through faith, for faith, as it is written, who through faith is righteous shall live."
Yeah.
Now that's not the greatest translation, I have to admit, but that's the I think the RSV translation.
Sure.
But that word faith occurs there in such an important way, doesn't it? And and you describe the Old Testament as being very key. We think, okay, there's not a lot of faith in the Old Testament. Well, au contraire,
that's right.
There's a whole lot of faith there, right? But it's understood in a different way than what we sometimes as Christians hear it. What are your thoughts on Romans 1:16-17?
Yeah, that's actually a very important passage, and it did definitely deserve its own chapter in the book. So here Paul is talking about his gospel. He says, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of salvation." So he is broadcasting his big ideas. You just asked about big ideas. Paul gives his big idea there, and he does center it on faith in Jesus Christ. He does back it up with Habakkuk 2:4, "The righteous will live by faith." And this is a really crucial moment for Paul. He's talking to a church that is kind of waiting to hear what his message is and is going to be vetting it and deciding whether it kind of fits with that with them. So he is kind of making a case for the Pauline gospel to them. And this is really instrumental because when he's talking about faith, part of what I talk about in relationship to Galatians, I would say my Galatians chapter is kind of the heart of the book, but the Roman stuff is definitely connected. Part of what Paul is accused of in his ministry, I just read recently a book by Udo Schnella on the first 100 years of Christianity. And in that book, Schnella talks about a counter mission against Paul. I've never heard it called that, but it makes sense that when you read Galatians, even when you read parts of Romans, when you read 2 Corinthians, when you read Philippians, you get the impression there is a Christian counter mission that took place against Paul. Paul was a man under attack. And part of the concern about Paul's message was that he was not preaching circumcision and Torah for Gentiles.
Right.
I think sometimes Paul is using pistis as a summary word or a kind of catchword to represent his Torah-free gospel. And so in Galatians, let's for example, when we look back to Galatians, he's battling with a group of rival teachers over how to appropriately study the story of the Old Testament, the story of Israel. And they want to point out how there's a direct line from Abraham to Moses and the law and so forth. And Gentiles need to come into the family through that pathway. And when Paul looks back to Abraham, he wants to create a new pathway around Moses in some ways. And he looks to Abraham not as the father of circumcision, not as the father of Torah, but as the father of pistis, of faith, or pistos, he says in Galatians 3:10, faithfulness. When we take Romans then, Romans chapter 1, you do have some repetition with Galatians, because in both cases he quotes Habakkuk 2:4. If some of these rival teachers wanted to focus on Leviticus or Deuteronomy or various Old Testament texts to show the centrality of Torah and Torah works for how to live out the Christian life, Paul found Habakkuk 2:4 so primal and central to his understanding of the gospel of Jesus Christ. What is the gospel of Jesus Christ all about? Look back to Abraham, look at Habakkuk 2:4. It's all about this pure, direct relationship with God, what I call unmediated agency. But the irony or the paradox is that unmediated agency is mediated through an agent named Jesus Christ. How can it be unmediated and mediated? That's the paradox in early Christianity. It's unmediated because Jesus Christ somehow brings you fully into an immersive relationship with God. Just as John, you know, we're talking about John before, John, you know, talks about, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. And Paul has a very similar mentality.
So, the way that you use this phrase, the Christ relation.
Yes.
In this. And one of the things I appreciate about you and Chris Tilling's work and a lot of people that talk about participation, Mike Gorman and others, is that there is this relationship and everything really, that is the planet you were talking about. And all these other things are the association, the satellites around it. And it seems to me that faith language in Paul is really like that. And it really is polyvalent, which is a great scholarly word, meaning it can mean a lot of stuff.
That's right.
Right? It's got a big semantic field.
Well, the verse I kept coming back to as I was studying Paul's faith language, Galatians 2:20, I've been crucified with Christ, and I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. And the life I live in the body, I live by pistis, with the God who loved, with the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. So that pistis is Paul's way of talking about plugging into, as it were, the Christ relation. And when people want to say, oh, faith means passive, I don't like to use the word passive. I'd like to say it's an active mode of engagement and receptivity. So if you think about like a wide receiver, they are receiving, but they're in an active mode of receiving.
Exactly. They're running down the field at 20 miles an hour. Right?
They're active. And so when people want to get into a formulaic approach to Christianity, you cannot fit pistis into that. It really is that messiness of a relationship that you get into that has the same elements of covenant, goodwill, and expectation. All relationships, all healthy relationships have goodwill and expectation. And I think that's crucial to understanding Paul's language of faith.
Well, it's a great book. We've been talking with Dr. Nijay Gupta about his book, Paul and the Language of Faith, here on the Stone Chapel. Dr. Gupta, thank you for coming and spending some time with us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you to Brent Johnson, our editor. Thanks as well to Phil Keggy for our music. These podcasts are made possible by the generosity of Mark and Becky Lanier and the Lanier Theological Library Foundation. If you have questions, comments, or would just like to be in touch, please email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. That's podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is L-A-N-I-E-R. Thanks for listening.